listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 191 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, and joining me is Chris Robley. Chris, how are you?
I'm having an artistic crisis.
Oh, you are? Well, that's... Step into my office,
yes.
Sit on my couch, and explain.
Okay, so since I put out my last record at the beginning of last year, I have written too many songs. I've probably written 65.
Is this like a humble brag? Are we?
Yes, I'm basically just setting up a humble brag. No, maybe, but it does lead me to this serious frustration. So I've written like 65 songs. I'm under no delusion that they're all great or worthy of putting on a record, but if I have 65 songs, like, I'm sure like 20, 25 of them are like pretty good. Like, you know, maybe I'm delusional, but. So what ends up happening is I feel like I'm like constantly way ahead of myself, and I don't have like the budget to go and record like a triple album. That would be ridiculous. Anyways, what the hell do I do? Like, so last night I actually said I had an idea for a song, and I said, I'm not going to write this song. I was like, well, this is stupid. Like, why would you not do it? But something about that felt healthy to me.
To me, that sounds about right. Because
don't just stop, don't write any more songs.
Well, here's the thing. Well, the funny thing is, every band I've been in, including Small Town Poets, has had the exact opposite problem. We've always had about the exact number of songs we needed to make the record, and we've never had the luxury of 30 songs paring it down to 10 for an album. Fortunately, I feel like I've been in some bands that I don't know if it was we were good at just weeding things out, but we never just had tons and tons of ideas laying around. We only worked on stuff that I think we felt really strongly about. The songs that didn't make the records, like Small Town Poets, there's probably like five or six out of the five records that there are. However, on like my own personal like creating ideas and other song ideas for other projects, I feel like I get halfway through an idea that I really like, and then instead of being able to just finish that, I start another idea and then another idea. And so I've got a folder of like, you know, 50 song ideas that are like, some of them are like for instrumental. You know, I like a lot of the instrumental
post-rock stuff. Yeah.
And so I have got tons of unfinished songs there. And I feel like my problem is I keep writing, coming up with new ideas that I really like, and it gets halfway, and then instead of finishing it, I do something new.
Well,
and so to me, I've been thinking about, I need to force myself to stop, lock myself in a room, and don't come out until the ones that I really like are finished, and just go from there.
Yeah, well, when I tally up the 60 or 65 songs, I'm not even talking about the ones that are half done or, you know, like fragments of ideas and stuff. That's a whole other list. So, and I started to realize, like, within the last month or two, every single new song I write that I'm excited about just makes me more and more unhappy. Just, I realize this is, I don't know if it's a humble brag or stupid
first world problem or something.
Me.
You're just better than me because all my songs are just half-baked.
No, I have tons of those too. And maybe they are half-baked and I just think they're done. But what ends up happening is I just feel so far behind, and so in terms of actually executing on recording and releasing and arranging, you know, because then I still have to, on lots of them, get a band together, and like my band's in Oregon and I'm in Maine, and everything about it is frustrating. Except the moment when I'm writing.
Just too much trouble. You should have just been a banker.
I was a banker, Kevin.
I know you.
before CD Baby rescued me.
That's right.
Anyways.
Well, interesting. Well, you know what I would say? I would pick the top ones that you like. I would just I would say stop and force yourself to do it, because with that many songs, you know, we talk about it all the time, building a catalog is one of the keys to driving a successful music career. Sure, you can have one-hit wonders or people that have one song, that's all they're ever known for. But, you know, here at CD Baby, a lot of the artists that we see that are making a full-time living from their music have just built a solid catalog over years, and that catalog just works for them over and over again. The more songs, the more streams you're going to get. So that's why I think it's important. You've always had that problem. You've always had more content than you've released, I think.
Oh, yeah, completely. But I mean, at least I do this time around. I don't think I've ever had this many songs that were unrecorded, but I've got like three or four friends who have committed to and convinced me that they're okay with doing this, listening to, like, if I make just crappy quick demos of all of them. They were like, no, seriously, send all of them. We'll help you, like, narrow it down, which is nice to know that I have some help there. But so really what I need to do is just find like a couple days to just make super quick crappy demos and
just do it with your guitar and Music Memos app.
That's exactly what I do. For real, that's how I make my demos.
Sometimes I actually like the little adding the drums thing on that. It's actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, if anyone wants to help out with Chris's plight, you can email the podcast or call in, and we can make that connection so you can help ease his pain. Speaking of recording and Small Town Poets, I'm going into the studio in Atlanta next week to hopefully knock out all the guitars for our new album. I've been procrastinating like crazy, which, you know, musicians do. And I've supposed to have been recording tracks at home. So I have the house to myself tonight and part of tomorrow. And so I'm determined to get some guitar tracks done.
You're then also going to Atlanta, though, to record?
Yeah, yeah. We've got like nine or 10 songs. And I've had Pro Tools sessions for like four of them for like 3-4 months. How many? I actually have done some recording. But
this is like your cram for the test moment in college or something.
I find that I'm more creative when it's just like, you got to do it. You've got 5 minutes. Get it done. But yes, so I have done some recording, but I'm not as far as I hope to be. But I will be home alone tonight. So I figure what will probably happen is I'll take a break at some point, get pizza and beer, and then wake up on the couch like at 2 a.m. going, oh, what happened? Not having gotten anything done. So we'll see.
That also sounds like a true musician.
Yeah. So it's trade-offs you make.
Well, if your band wants 50 more songs, I've got some to spare.
All right. Well, you can. You haven't asked me, but I'm more than happy to be on the list of people who lend an ear.
Oh, all right. Thanks. You don't know what you're asking for.
All right. We've got a good discussion ahead of us that doesn't pertain to our recording exploits. We're going to be talking about music streaming myths, and we're going to debunk some of those myths. And there's a lot of people that are still don't know what to make of this streaming economy. So we're going to talk about that, and we're going to get to some news. But first, I want to remind everybody that there are, like, probably by the time you hear this, maybe 100 tickets left for the DIY Musician Conference. It's probably going to sell out the week I post this podcast episode, because the price is going to go up on July 12th. To $129 for the ticket. So if you want to get in on the conference at $99, you need to buy now. But as I mentioned on the last episode of the podcast, there are some cool opportunities that are arising for those coming to Nashville to take part in the conference, one being YouTube and their pop-up studio. Some of our listeners emailed me asking for the link to submit for that, and there is still lots and lots of room to get your name on that list. Fewer people emailed than you would think. So a lot of times, taking advantage of an opportunity is just actually following through and submitting for something. So you can email podcast@cdbabypodcast.com if you want the link to the form where you can submit for that pop-up opportunity. You do have to be in Nashville all day on Thursday the 24th. That is the one requirement. So if you're going to be there, I highly recommend you submit for that opportunity. But you can get tickets at DIYMusicianCon.com. Chris and I actually are going to be doing a live podcast taping like we have done in years past. And the topic we decided on, I think, is going to be a good one. We'll hold on. We won't share what that topic is going to be yet.
Okay. This is
let's leave it. Leave a little intrigue, a little mystery around it, but I think it's going to be a good one. It's going to be a fun discussion, and we just love hanging out with everybody there, so definitely get your tickets to the conference, and I hope to see you in Nashville August 25th through 27th. It's coming up. It's like a month and a half away, which is frightening. So much work that still has to be done to pull that thing off, but it's going to be amazing. Nashville's amazing, and we have some good friends in Nashville now. A lot of listeners to the podcast that come and hang out, and we have a good time. All right. With that said, let's get to the news.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
Music.
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 News.
Some big news on the SoundCloud front. SoundCloud is closing its offices in London and San Francisco as it lays off 40% of its workforce in a dramatic cost-cutting move. The German-born streaming company has informed its staff that 173 jobs are being cut from a total headcount of 420. The business will consolidate its operation across the New York and Berlin offices. The last available annual accounts for SoundCloud are for 2015, when revenues were up 21% to $22 million, but net losses accelerated 30% to $52 million. When these figures were filed in January, SoundCloud CEO and co-founder Alexander Leung noted that the company may run out of cash before the end of 2017 if it could not secure further financing. Recent rumors have suggested that Deezer could acquire SoundCloud in the coming months. We need to ensure our path to long-term independent success, Leung said in a blog post today. He commented that the business has doubled its revenue over the past 12 months, but didn't reveal what has happened to losses. Leung said, "By reducing our costs and continuing our revenue growth, we're on a path to profitability and in control of SoundCloud's independent future." From Digital Music News, proving the music industry has surpassed album exclusives, fans have pirated Jay-Z's 444 more than a million times. To boost its fledgling music service, Apple signed artists like Frank Ocean into timed album exclusive deals. Fan could listen to these albums on Apple Music before it hit other streaming services like Spotify. Jay-Z quickly followed suit on his own Tidal service with major names like Kanye West and Beyoncé. The music industry has moved on from album exclusives, yet in an attempt to bolster his floundering service, Jay-Z released 444 exclusively on Tidal. The move has proven successful if you count the number of times people have pirated the album, that is. Released exclusively on Tidal on June 30th, 444 has been illegally downloaded nearly a million times. According to piracy monitoring specialist Muzo, people downloaded the album 971,000 times in 72 hours. Popular piracy networks include the Pirate Bay. The number has most likely surpassed 1 million downloads to date. So why have people chosen to pirate the album? The problem lies in Jay-Z's insistence on continuing with Tidal-only album exclusives. The heavily restricted album limits fans' ability to legally stream the music and thus help the music industry. Even worse, Tidal limited the album to people who had subscribed to the service 4 days before its release. In a recent piece analyzing Jay-Z's decision to release the album only on Tidal, Paul Reznikoff of Digital Music News touched on the problem. He wrote, "Album exclusives piss off the fans and punish paying subscribers who are supporting the music industry. They cause huge spikes in piracy, which means the money goes out of the industry's pocket." And those are the two news items, two streaming news items that will play into the discussion coming up. And I think this Jay-Z release is a perfect example of what not to do, which we'll be talking about later.
Right. It's also just so kind of sad. It's like that story is depressing on several fronts, not just for the fans, but just the fact that you use fledgling service for Tidal. That's sad, too. I'm very sad.
Yeah, and the thing is, when you dig a little deeper into the news story about that and follow more of the articles, you know, Kanye West did an exclusive, and I don't know if you remember, there was this big, giant promotion about Kanye's exclusive on Tidal, and it was supposed to be there, I believe, for 30 days, but then it came out, Kanye got pissed and like broke the deal and released it instantly everywhere.
Right.
And it's because you realize that none of your fans
have access.
Have access, at least a portion of them. And that it's, you know, we'll be talking about this more later, but that's just a prime example. If it doesn't work for superstars, it's not going to work for you. So that's a trend that started that people are moving away from.
On the SoundCloud front, I also got a laugh out of that story when a company that's been around for years and years and years and years and years is still approaching profitability, in quotes. Like, what a world we live in.
Yeah.
I mean, I know some of our favorite music streaming platforms are also in that boat, but...
Yeah, it's just funny that it's like... Hey, it's positive. We doubled revenues. Losses may have tripled, but you know, it's like right. We've got revenues up. It doesn't make any sense. Well, plus the thing about SoundCloud is like they went out and got these very lavish offices in like San Francisco and New York, the top properties, and they, you know, had sleeping pods in the office and had these famous architects do them, and it's like when you don't have profitability, maybe you shouldn't put all that money into those things.
Right. I mean, I'm no business historian, but I just wonder how much of the, you know, was Andrew Carnegie running businesses like that?
Probably not, because I think back then you had to have money to do things.
Right.
I'm sure things were leveraged, but not making no money for years on end with hopes of having some giant payday, you know, with it, getting investors to throw in money. I don't know.
Was it Andrew Carnegie? The other Carnegie wrote that book. I don't know if I'm getting my Carnegies right. Anyways, we can move on from the business history lesson, which has failed.
Yeah, because neither of us are qualified to provide an adequate business lesson here. But it is, you know, it is sad. I was a big fan of SoundCloud when they first launched because they were geared towards creators and their app was all around... being able to, you know, record and upload tracks and store them in the cloud. Then they definitely decided that, hey, we're not as interested in that anymore. We want to be a streaming service. And they kind of turned their back on the creator community for a bit, and their app removed all the recording features. And then they tried to backpedal some, and it just feels like they haven't had a strong purpose that feels defined. I know in certain genre groups that they're really popular, but
yeah, I know like a lot of hip hop fans.
EDM is huge.
Yeah, they're communicating with each other. They're actually using the platform as like a community and as a way to comment on tracks and all that. But for me, the only use I've ever felt for it, because I don't like listening to music on SoundCloud. The only use I've found for it is sharing private tracks with bloggers ahead of a release, you know, for promo stuff. But besides that, I kind of am never on SoundCloud.
Yeah, I personally don't like their interface. Some people love it. Their UI, user experience of navigating the site. I personally don't care for it. And so that's why I've always strayed away. I think it's definitely designed for a song-by-song bundling. I know they added album bundling recently, but yeah. So it's just interesting to see what happens. You know, there's rumors flying that this was a move in order to get it sold. We'll see. Something's going to happen. Someone will buy it. They're not going to close it down. Someone will buy it, and it's to be determined if it will go the way of MySpace, which still exists. Most people don't know. It's been handed around several times. But... who knows if it'll go that way or if someone can give it new life and purpose and kind of carve out its space where it can be around for the long haul. All right, let's get on to our discussion.
Let's do it. Let's debunk some myths.
All right, so we are going to be discussing music streaming myths, and we're going to debunk those myths. Now, here's sort of the background information for why this discussion. There's a broad range of artists that still are all over the map when it comes to streaming. For people that are new to the market, whether you're a younger artist or you just finally got around to having time for making music and releasing music and you're just entering the market, this might feel like a what's the big deal conversation, because if you're new to the market, you've probably come into it with streaming as a key factor. And as it transitions to the main way people engage music, you're used to that idea. So we see artists all the time here at CD Baby that are in that camp. We still see a huge number of artists that are still, I will say, in the middle area, in like the transitional period. Like, they're still unsure how streaming is going to play out. They've been hearing a lot of negative headlines. They don't know what to think. They still see, you know, download sales and CD sales, which are a big part of what they do, and wonder how they can, you know, keep those things rolling without losing everything to streaming. So we see a lot of people in that camp. Then, like, the other camp is the doom and gloom. I refuse to partake in streaming. I am only going to offer my music for downloads and CDs. My fans need to come get this. I am not going to put my music on streaming services because I want to make money for my music. And there's a lot of nuance in between those main three buckets. But that's a lot of what we see still. Am I correct, Chris, in that statement?
Yeah, well, what I notice is that the last camp you talked about is usually the most vocal. So I think that also maybe clouds people's opinion, or, you know, certainly obscures some of the facts about it, because the doom and gloom is the most headline-friendly voice, I guess. So a lot of people have ill-informed opinions, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, we're in the formal transition period, I would say, that that creates a lot of confusion. We're transitioning from one format to another. And in the internet age, confusion breeds fear, which then drives all the myths and crazy talk on the internet. And sometimes it's hard to know what's real and what's true and what's a piece of the truth that's being highlighted to drive someone's agenda. So we wanted to talk about these things and take it step by step, some of the big myths. And so let's get started. Are you going to lead us, Chris, or do you want
sure.
me to take the reins?
Yeah, well, here's the first myth. There's no money in streaming. I think that is maybe the most common myth. And it's perpetuated by huge megastar artists who, you know, complain that they had millions and millions of streams and only had enough money to go buy a sandwich, which I think is due in large part to the fact that A, their publishing royalties might be split between 12 different writers and producers if they even have any credit on the song. So that's one way in which their potential royalties are being diluted, I guess. And then the other is that they're probably on a label who's taken some giant advance or just taken the payment for the sound recording being streamed and kept it, like they have been known to do for 40 or 50 or 100 years.
No, that never happens. Yeah, so a lot of the headlines that claim there's no money in streaming, what's frustrating about this to me is if we're going to have positive conversations about properly compensating artists and songwriters, we got to talk from a place of real understanding. And it's, you know, it's the same thing we see in politics and all this kind of stuff. Everyone's shouting their sound bites, but the world is far more complex than a sound bite. And there's gray area, there's things to figure out, there's lots that goes into something like this. So, for example, it happens all the time, like you outlined, an article. There's no money in streaming. I had a million streams and got a check for $5. And it's an artist on a label. They're not saying if they wrote the song. Do they have 100% of the publishing? Do they have 100% of the writer's share? What's their label deal? Their album probably hasn't recouped. So there's all these details that get conveniently left out just to have a splashy headline and drive fear and concern. So that's the first thing with there's no money in it, that for an independent artist that makes 100% of the money and 100% of the publishing, there's money there. And there's just some recalibrating that has to be done.
Yeah, and I know we've touted the success story of Perrin Lam a bunch of times. He had one song placed on a high-profile playlist a couple years ago, and I think he made, just from that single song placement, $56,000 on Spotify. You know, that doesn't even include all of his other revenues for that song, all the other platforms it's available on. But just last night, I was listening to an interview that Charlie Rose did with Jason Isbell, and he was saying, talking about streaming, and he said, you know, I used to think there was, I'm paraphrasing, but basically, I used to think there was no money in this, and then I became my own label, and I got a check from the streaming platforms to the label, and I got a check as an artist, and the label check was pretty sizable, and the artist one was tiny, and suddenly, all of that money is his, both of those checks. But previous to that, he thought, oh, the artists just don't make anything, and then he said, aha, that's where all the money's going.
Yeah, artists are so quick to sign any little contract just to feel like they're being validated in their art. I know what that feels like. I've been there. But there's a lot of stuff in those contracts that are ways for labels to skim things off the top so you don't get your money. So the bottom line is, when it comes down to the streaming debate, you need to first validate the source is actually giving you credible information and all the details, which oftentimes I've yet to see an article that truly does to really understand what's going on. But I mentioned you have to recalibrate your thinking. For the longest time, I heard this over and over from artists, like, I had 10,000 downloads of my last album. Now I'm only going to get 10,000 streams. And I'm like, why on earth did we somehow just assume 10,000 streams and 10,000 downloads were the same thing? That somebody who downloaded a song is now just going to stream it once and never come back to it.
So that seems like a whole other myth we could debunk, which is that a stream equals a download. That's clearly not the case. I think that's where you're going with that thought.
Yeah, for the longest time in the industry, we've sort of had the idea that this 1 million is this magic number. 1 million albums sold, you go platinum, that's kind of an indicator of some success. Usually it means you're doing well, making some money, and going to have a long career. And so then streaming comes along, and people have been holding on to that same number, as if 1 million streams should have the same status as 1 million albums sold. 1 million streams is great, but it's really more like, I don't know. Let me do some math here, because actually we have some numbers to help us recalibrate how we think about this. So the RIAA, they're the ones that certify albums as platinum and gold. The RIAA recognizes one equivalent album unit as one album sales. So if you sold an album, 10 tracks sold. So if you have people buying 10 tracks individually, they consider, okay, that'll account for an album, even if it's not all the same album or it's 10 of the same song or whatever. Or 1,500 on-demand audio or video streams. So basically 150 streams equals one download. So if we're talking 1 million divided by 150, we're talking, you know, about close to 6,700 album sales equivalents, which then when you start looking at the money, that actually adds up to be pretty accurate. The idea of someone buying an album is different than someone hitting play on a streaming service. Now, I think there's some advantages to the fact that all it takes is someone hitting play. And the thing that people have started seeing with streaming services is, oh, actually the base level of streams I'm getting is actually higher than I would have expected, because these platforms are doing things to feature music. It's easier for people to just hit play and listen to an album without a purchasing commitment. And actually, in the long run, I might be reaching more people. And I think it's interesting when you look around Spotify. I pulled up Ed Sheeran, because if you pull up Ed Sheeran on Spotify and you click the About link, you see that he's got this little badge that he's the number one streamed artist in the world on Spotify.
The top dog.
He's got almost 45 million monthly listeners. That means every month, 45 million people are listening to him. He never would have sold 45 million albums.
What's his song? Shape of You has more than 1 billion streams just on Spotify.
Yeah, so if you take 1 billion streams, like from his top songs, top 10 songs, I think we were saying there's close to 3 or 4 billion streams represented. When you plug that into a Spotify royalty calculator, which you can find online, that's millions and millions of dollars. So it's sort of this recalibration that needs to happen. This is a top pop superstar who has, you know, billions of streams for his latest album just on Spotify alone from the last couple months. When you think about it and start thinking about, okay, in the heyday of the music business, what did a superstar sell as far as album sales? And you start thinking, 2, 3, 4 million, 10 million. And you start doing the math, it starts to add up and be pretty equivalent. And so it's just a matter of adjusting what we think is success, because a million streams is not a million album sales, and we got to recalibrate. And I think once you do, the doom and gloom starts to fade, and some of the misconceptions about how much you should be making and what status you're really at for the amount of streams you have.
Yeah, and all of those economics reflect the fact that there's, as you said, almost no barrier to entry for someone to explore your music, which ultimately I think is a great, great thing for particularly for unknown musicians.
I think the number that's pretty fascinating to me when I look around at artists and their Spotify profiles is that average monthly listeners, because I find that number is far higher than it ever would have been if it had been the average number of people who had a CD and were listening to the CD that month. It would be much, much lower. I don't know if there's even a way to figure out what that'd be, but I guarantee it'd be like at least a tenth of that, if not less, maybe a hundredth of that. So you're reaching a much broader audience, and those numbers add up fast. So the economics are just totally different. And so you got to get over the thinking that you're comparing apples to apples when you're comparing to what you used to see in download sales, because it's just not the same.
Yeah. Well, another myth we could talk about is that streaming killed the album. So when I was in college and a friend of mine wanted to listen to The Devil Went Down to Georgia, he had to buy Charlie Daniels Band Greatest Hit CD. He had the whole album. Now, a year later, Napster launches. And as soon as Napster became a thing, none of my friends were buying CDs. They were just making these playlists online of all this stuff they downloaded. And the album died then. It wasn't streaming that killed it. It was downloads. And so if anything, I think, as I said, the low barrier of entry for someone to explore your music actually bodes well for the album to make a kind of comeback. Maybe it's not a 10 song album, maybe it's an EP, but a kind of larger collection of one artist's songs. You could fall in love with a song and then decide to just keep listening to that person's whole playlist or whole album. And I think Spotify and Apple Music helps the album.
Yeah. And so far what I've been seeing is that these platforms tend to reward artists that are doing a single and album strategy together, that there's these algorithms powering things, and a couple singles leading up to an album release really prime the pump and really help make that album launch more successful. And that, you know, the more content you release, the more people that are saving your music to their playlists, their My Music on whatever app they're using, whether it's Apple Music or Spotify or anywhere else, that's indicators that, people are engaging with this. This album should be featured or has these opportunities. So there's things that are happening in the background that get rewarded by the releasing of content and people engaging with the content. And so the idea of like, I just got to release singles now, I think that's a false assumption. And I think you're right that I think the album might actually make a bit of a comeback and have a more of a purpose than people realized when they, started thinking that, people can just buy everything a la carte now. Why do we need to make albums?
Yeah. And I think maybe the simplest way to say it for the consumer is streaming makes it so easy to take a chance on things. You weren't going to do that when you had to pay, 99 cents per song on iTunes or $10 for the whole album. So it's exciting times.
Yep. Yep.
The next myth we have on the list refers back to a news item, which is that I can window or withhold my music from streaming services in order to drive more physical sales and downloads. So, you know, Jay-Z basically encouraged 1 million people to steal his music.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that was probably the first one that was pretty easy to document the negative effect of it, because it would, you know, there's services that are doing a better job of tracking piracy and such like that. So I get this question when I travel for CD Baby and go to conferences. I get this question all the time. Should I window? No, don't do that. Even for the superstars, it's not working. And it's not working for him because there's all these people, most of the music fans in the world have not chosen to use Tidal. And so why force them all to use Tidal when they don't want to use Tidal? Now, I understand the idea of trying to build incentives for people to use that music service, but I feel like the reason for someone to use a music service should be just built into the music service. Like with Tidal, it's supposed to be high-res streaming. It shouldn't be that we only have this particular album, because most of the people that aren't using it are just not going to care, or they'll go find it somewhere else and pirate it. It'd be interesting to see the percentage of people that pirated that album that had a music subscription service elsewhere, because that would be the real telling point. But for the independent artist, if you're trying to build a fan base, you want your music to be available everywhere possible. I always use this example. I would hate to be playing a show and someone who came with a, you know, someone who's just there because they came to the show with a friend and weren't really invested in us as artists and didn't really know who we were, heard us, liked what we were doing, pulled out their Spotify app, searched for us, didn't find us, and then just put it away and moved on with their life. They're not going to go digging on the internet and go scour everything looking, wow, I must find this band. There's just too much music available. So those are just missed opportunities. If you remove your music from certain services where a portion of the music fans are.
Yeah, and I've, you know, said this a number of times on this podcast, but basically if your music isn't on Spotify or maybe YouTube, I'm not going to hear it. I'm not going to open your CD, you know, most likely, because when I'm in the car, that's the only place I have a CD player, and that's like NPR time. So, you know, just don't be a pain in the ass. Although I should say that we should put an asterisk on this particular myth, because in a blog post I made similar to this discussion, some artists did comment and say, you know what, I window my releases and it works for me. You know, they explain a little bit about their audience, and, you know, if it's like the 35 and up crowd, and you really know who your fans are, and, you know, obviously I should trust you, the artist, to know what's best, more than whatever advice we're giving you. And so, you know, this guy was like, I sell physical CDs to them first and then it becomes available here. And that seems to be working for him economically. So it's not like it never works, but by and large, as a strategy, it probably will fail way more times than it will succeed.
Yeah, there's always exceptions to the rule. And you know your fan base better than anyone else. This, what we're really speaking to is the idea that, oh, this is how it works now. This is what you're supposed to do. And just blindly doing these things because you've read some article or saw an artist do it and just assumed a lot of things and thought, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do now. Anytime you get strategic with your fan base and you know it's going to work, I absolutely encourage that. And also, I should say, we're talking about streaming myths being debunked. And we're talking a lot about streaming and the opportunities there. That does not mean that we do not advocate for other revenue streams as well. Downloads are great. CDs are great. We're just talking about streaming for the sake of conversation, so that we're not saying that this should be your only revenue stream, because it shouldn't.
Yeah. And obviously always point your fans to the place where it benefits you, but also have it available everywhere else.
Yeah, I think that being strategic about where will it benefit me most. For some people, it may be Spotify. For some people, it might be their CD Baby page or their Bandcamp page where they have better pricing control. For other people, it might be iTunes. I think, you know, and then like with Bandcamp and CD Baby, you might have physical product or your own band website where you have your own store built in. You want to send your diehard fans where it benefits you the most. But yeah, you don't want to remove it from places because you think you're getting tricky, or that's what you're supposed to do because that's what Jay-Z did, and it seemed to work okay for him.
Yeah. So the next myth on the list is that all streaming services are pretty much the same, which surprisingly is something I hear a lot. Like, well, it's just digital files, and the service is the place where I just go to access it. So everything's, you know, what's the big difference between all these things? But, you know, at least with the most popular ones, there's a pretty huge difference. Like, there's YouTube Red, which, you know, comes with all of the YouTube videos in existence that are basically served up to you ad-free. Pandora Premium has, you know, ways in which it draws upon the Pandora radio experience you might have had over the past, you know, whatever amount of years in order to teach it how to build playlists for you. Apple Music's got its radio station and it's really into its human curated playlists. And then Spotify's like the kind of, not that it's open source, but it has that sort of mentality of like, let's get all our users to teach this algorithm how to serve up music that you're going to like. So that there are pretty stark differences between them.
That's one thing that it took me a while to dive in and really understand. You know, I finally took the plunge and like, I'm going to learn Spotify. And when I got in there, I realized, oh, there's so many interesting things that this service does that are to the benefit of the artist that don't exist on Apple Music. And Apple Music has some things that work that aren't on Spotify and Amazon Music and Google Play, and all these platforms are building things in different ways and have algorithms that, you know, do cause different things to happen that are different algorithms. And whether it be like Discover Weekly playlists or just what you see when you open the app up. So a lot of it is data driven and they do things differently and have different options. And so one, I think it's important to gauge what service or platform your fans tend to gravitate towards. It was interesting, this 20th anniversary thing we did with Small Town Poets a couple months back. I had I emailed out and what we were gonna be doing, and I had a link to the album. I had it on Apple Music and on Spotify, and I think I had it, and I didn't have it, that one's still on a label, so I don't have a place where I can send people for a CD because it's out of print. I was actually surprised that the majority of people clicked on the iTunes link, not Apple Music, it was iTunes. Clicked on iTunes, and I was like, huh, maybe for our audience, which I would say a lot of our fans that have been with us for the long haul, they're definitely probably my age or a little bit younger, there might be diehard iTunes users still. So I might be making some assumptions about our fan base that aren't specifically true to them compared to the rest of the industry. So I think it's interesting to do some testing to see what services your fans are using. You might find out that a lot of your fans have Android phones and use Google Play or YouTube Red, or, you know, there's all sorts of different things. Or your fans might be mainly YouTube watchers. They watch and listen to music on YouTube. And so it's good to figure that out because they're not all the same, and how you engage with your fan base might be different based on that information.
Yeah, and a very, very basic point, which maybe is a given, is that your fans might be in a completely different place than where you favor. You know, I think sometimes as artists we think, well, I love Spotify, so clearly all my fan base is on Spotify. Or I'm a YouTuber, so that's what, you know, like, look at the data, ask them, figure that out, because they might have very different preferences than you do.
Yeah, and there's some great data you can get in your CD Baby account, and sometimes it's just send your fans an email saying, where do you listen to music? And just let them select where they listen to it. And that's it. Just ask them. And, you know, then you get some good information.
Yeah. Well, we're approaching my two favorite myths. Okay. So here they are.
I can't wait.
And these are things we actually hear pretty often. It's only a matter of time before people realize they miss having the tangible physical record or CD. Are you serious? Like,
Chris, it's only a matter of time.
So this, you know, misses that whole point that you made early on in this discussion, that for a lot of people, they never had those things. They have not grown up needing or wanting CDs or vinyl records. They are, you know, quote, digital natives or whatever, streaming natives. And this is the way it is. Why are they going to... They're not yearning for the nostalgia that you have.
No, but I will say there's always, and this is what someone will say, they'll throw back at you. Certain things from the past become a gimmick. Just like tapes had a little resurgence for like 15 minutes last year. And it's like, oh, that's so funny. I'm going to buy a tape. But in reality, that was just a little gimmick. So someone might go, I'm going to go get a CD player and CDs just to be
like,
you know,
retro ironic cool.
Counterculture retro ironic, yes.
What?
So that might happen, but that's not the industry turning or being driven. That's more of just that I'm going to be retro and ironic type crowd that will do that.
What?
Get everyone going, yes, we see you. We acknowledge you're ironic and retro. And now we can move on.
Sweet mustache, man. No, but I love vinyl. Like, I get it. I have plenty of vinyl records. And so I personally have that nostalgia. But I don't fool myself in thinking that this is going to be a trend that reverses itself. Everything is about becoming more available, more immediate, less expensive to the consumer. And vinyl prices are going up and up and up. So, you know, that's, while vinyl has had a resurgence, it's not going to it's not going to overtake streaming. So let's give up on all of those hopes.
Yes, it's not going to come back. And unless something really traumatic happens in the world where technology goes away, or the internet goes away, we'll all have bigger problems then than we will, what format we're choosing to listen to music on. It might just be gathering around the campfire at that point. But
well, that's an interesting point, though, because I've been thinking about how, when CDs were a thing, people bemoaned the loss of the, big vinyl sleeve with all of this, artwork and it felt so visceral. And then when downloads came out, people were complaining that there was no CD sleeve. And so again, the nostalgic part of me gets that. But ultimately what we're talking about is music. It's just the sound, the delivery, and all the stuff that surrounds it is not really important to someone who's never had it. Like when Mozart was playing in some king's castle, there was no album sleeve. It was just people lit.
He wasn't sitting there looking at the sleeve
while
he played.
It was just people listening to the music. And like, so that's the same thing that's happening now. They're listening in a different way, but they're listening to music. And that's basically all that matters.
So basically this is retro. It's just like Mozart days. You just listen to the music.
We're going all the way back.
I do like the idea of some sort of physical thing with the album that I really love. Not necessarily a CD. It could be a CD. But, you know, it is fun to feel like the world of the album release is bigger than just the music you're listening to. But I think that's something totally different and a different discussion that probably goes back to some of the branding discussions we've had and like the last episode of the podcast, and less about having, you know, something that represents the music itself in a physical format.
Yeah.
Speaking of Mozart, I always think that era, it must have been just amazing that when you heard music, that like people playing, that was the only way and the only time you could hear it. It's not like you go, oh, I really like that song, I'm gonna go home and listen to it some more. It's like, no, we got to get everybody together, someone's gonna write something, and then we're gonna all sit here and listen to it and decide if we like it or not.
And if you really fell in love with the magic flute and it's a year later and you're like, oh, I want to go hear the magic flute, well, that's not the opera that's happening anymore. Like, you got some whole other concerto or symphony or something to digest.
So those guys had to be really good to write music that was so memorable that people wanted to hear so much that they heard it once and maybe had a chance to hear it maybe once or twice again in their entire lives, but yet it stood the test of time.
That sounds like a whole other podcast discussion as well. you writing these ideas down?
Sure. Oh, I'll listen back to this episode and take notes.
Well, this kind of actually leads into the last myth, which is something I hear constantly in comments on the DIY Musician blog. If we boycott streaming, everyone will have to go back to, and then, you know, insert your format, downloads, CDs, cassette, vinyl, wax cylinder, concert halls, folk dances. So, you know, the first thing I think is, you know, okay, you're complaining about streaming, about all these things, and you're saying we just need to boycott. All right, try it. I'm like, I'm all for organized, demonstrations and things like that. But ultimately, it comes back to the fact that Ed Sheeran isn't boycotting streaming services because he's benefiting greatly from it, because there's money there, because it's helping him connect with his fans and sell tickets and all this stuff. So, like, if it's working, it'll work for you too. You know, maybe at, obviously not at Ed Sheeran's level yet. You'll all one day be Ed Sheeran.
A lot of the doom and gloom about streaming and the bad headlines all come from the artist community. And like I said, it's very important to have honest discussions about how artists are compensated, how songwriters are compensated, with the real information and not these splashy headlines and manipulated stories that a lot of people use to sort of form their opinions. But those discussions need to happen. But I don't hear many people from the artist side who, you know, if you think about your music as a business, you are supplying a product and you have your consumer side of it, the music fan. I don't hear a lot of outrage on the music fan side of things.
I hear zero outrage.
In fact,
outrage,
I think a lot of music fans are actually far more engaged with more music, more artists than they ever imagined, than ever before in the history of the world.
And because it travels.
So that's got to be considered.
Yeah, and it travels, their stereo travels with them in their pockets. So they're listening way more hours a day than people probably used to.
Yeah, and all over the world, people have instant access to music. So when artists think about what they want, I think so often is completely removed from the conversation what the music fan wants. So when you talk about boycotting something, it's going to be a lonely boycott if you aren't really taking a broader perspective of who's using these services and whether or not they like them or not. I mean, if you're talking about boycotting by removing all your music and everyone removing their music, then maybe the fans just go to
exactly.
Somebody else. There's not a scarcity of music. So when to order boycott, you have to own the scarcity. You got to be able to control the supply and really create a scarcity.
And
that's
exactly what they mean. They want to organize and remove their music from these services. And to which I'm always thinking, well, the listener will just go to Ed Sheeran and Drake and all these megastars, Taylor Swift, that do have their music now on all these services. You know, your boycott won't matter. And all of this isn't to say that, like, you can't press for higher royalty rates and lobby Congress. And, you know, even Spotify reps have said that they don't think the streaming pay rate is quite enough. That's a whole separate discussion. The fact is there is money there, and there, you know, it is not going anywhere as a medium for transmitting music.
Exactly. I've been so optimistic about streaming, and as it develops and we start setting more proper expectations, as we see more superstars release music and kind of adjust where we think the market is and go, oh, okay, I was thinking millions, but Ed Sheeran just did 10 billion in 2 months. All right, now I need to really go, I've got a better expectation of where I really fit with 100,000 streams or 200,000 streams. And, you know, and these platforms just have some amazing things that they're doing to really push music further and deeper into the listeners' ears. And it's so much easier to get people to push play and listen, engage with your music, than it is to get people to make a purchase. And I think it changes the equation in the artist's favor, where your discussion between you and your fans is more about the music and engaging them in a way that just piques their interest enough to hit play and give it a chance, as opposed to trying to be a salesman and get them to buy something. And I think as artists, the opportunity is huge.
I'll just say I agree. I'll close this discussion out with I agree.
I'm sure we'll have lots of opinions, feedback. If you want to weigh in, if you think we're all wrong, if you do think we're all wrong, please, I encourage you, call 360-524-2209. Controversial calls make it to the top of the list. We haven't had a good one in a while. Email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. You can weigh in on the show notes at cdbabypodcast.com. And again, that number is 360-524-2209. Speaking of emails, we've got a couple emails, and let's get to them. This first email is from Matt. So here it is. Hi, guys. I can't seem to find the answer to this, but I released my EP through CD Baby and had a few vloggers, video bloggers, that were interested in using my music as background for their videos. And this was a direct quote from one of the vloggers who has over 30,000 subscribers, and Matt was hoping to get some exposure. So this is what the vlogger said. Just wanted to let you know I tried using one of your songs in my recent video, and the video was copyright claimed, meaning I couldn't monetize the video unless I made the video silent. Therefore, I cannot use any of the songs provided unless they are copyright free. Sorry about this. So Matt asked, how can he fix this for future videos? So what I told Matt is that, one, he needed to be aware of what this video guy was trying to do. He was trying to get Matt's music for free in order for him to create video content that he makes, that the vlogger makes money off of. So not necessarily anything wrong with that. I just wanted to make sure that it was clear that the guy wants Matt to turn off monetization of the music in order to monetize his video content. So this happens a lot. We get this question a lot at CD Baby, and there's several options. If you think the video channel is worth your while to let them use your music for free because the exposure will be so great, then you can turn monetization off on that track. And there's ways you can whitelist a specific channel and things like that. You'll have to email us to make that happen. It gets, you know, pretty in the weeds as far as details, and most artists don't want to do this. But you can turn monetization off on that. My advice to Matt was, I would make darn sure that that channel is actually using it in a way that provides some decent exposure for me, because if not, you know, some other things you could do is, you could still turn monetization off on that track, but ask for a sync fee, because that's basically what they're doing. You can ask for an upfront sync fee saying, hey, you know, you can use the song, I'll turn monetization off, you can monetize your video, but I want $500. Or since it's a video and YouTube channel, they're probably not going to give you that, but maybe $100 or $200. Just depends on the channel and how big their following is. But, you know, if it's not worth the promotion opportunity, I'd probably just decline and say never mind and just leave my music monetized. Because one thing you should know is, when you have monetized music on a video, the music trumps the video channel. So like he's saying, the person uploading the video to YouTube can't monetize that video because there's a copyright claim from the music.
Is there no way to arrange a split so that, like, the copyright warning stays in place on that person's channel, but they... you know, maybe a third goes to the music, a third goes to the video producer, or, you know, whatever. They split it in some way?
Not in YouTube. And there's discussion and talks about being able to better do that, because in theory, this shouldn't happen. The music should get paid for the usage, and the video should get paid for the usage. One shouldn't trump the other. So there's discussion, and I'm sure that'll be worked out in the future with the YouTube platform, but right now there's not really, unless the artist calculated the revenue from that video, and then, you know, when they got paid for it months later, paid the video owner. But that's just right. Too much trouble. It's probably not worth it. I don't know. It just depends. It might be worth it if, you know, they put a link and the call out, you know, they do something, if they've got a rabid fan base. You know, 30,000 subscribers on YouTube could mean a lot of things. They could be diehard fans that are super engaged, that might go stream and buy your music. In that case, absolutely. If it's just like background music that no one's going to notice, nah, I wouldn't do it. Thanks for the email, Matt. All right, we've got one more email. This one's kind of long, but I think it's good. I'm going to summarize the first part. Basically, this is from Connor. Connor has a band, but really the band started as Connor's solo project. So Connor started this thing. He paid a ton of money for the album to be made, but his band guys want to be more. They're all in. They don't want Connor to have to carry the financial load by himself, because they feel invested in this as well. So that's the backstory. And it's kind of long, but I think it's good. It might be a topic worthy of its own podcast episode in the future, but here we go. This is partway through his email already, so just so you know. We have recently recorded a new EP that I paid for that cost a pretty penny, and have invested a good amount of money in general for the band. We've had a few meetings recently to discuss moving forward, and the guys wanted to invest some money and help pitch in with everything. We have all become great friends and are very open about the situation we're in. They feel like it's too much of a burden to continue to front all the money, and they're super excited for what's ahead and want to be a part of it. Some bandmates were able to pitch in with some money to get merch. Others weren't able but still want to help in some way. However, now that they have pitched in a little cash and I also gave them some percentages of the master and publishing, everything has become extremely muddy and we're unsure how to split everything from here on out. We want to find something that's fair for everyone. I want to make some money back from my investment. He says, obviously not all, because that would take forever. They want to help out and also make it worth their while. And we also want to start a band fund. We've tried over and over again to come up with a fair percentage for everyone, and there are countless ideas that end up being shut down by one issue. My general question is, have you had any experience with having to bring on band members as investors after you have personally put in a lot of money? He said, I should be listening to your advice of not sending a novel via email, so I completely understand if you're not able to answer the question, but I figured I'd reach out. And he says, we're looking into hiring a financial advisor for a bit or a lawyer, but I figured there are a lot of others out there that are unsure of how to handle band finances in general and thought it'd be a good podcast episode. So that was Connor's email and question. It was long, but I think it was a good one. Chris, you've had a solo career, but you've had like steady band guys that have felt pretty invested in what you're doing. Do you have any advice?
I do, but I think I would have more questions first. Namely, what exactly are the splits they agreed upon? And if you all agreed on publishing splits and splits of ownership of the sound recording, what is the issue? Like, besides just accounting, you know, you make $100, how do you split it up? Well, you split it up according to those percentages that you've already agreed on. So am I missing something beyond that?
Well, I think this is the deal. My assumption would be that Connor is the main songwriter. I'm making some assumptions here. So if Connor wants to weigh in again and we can give an update later, that might help. But I'm going to make some assumptions. I'm going to assume that Connor writes all the songs and probably brings them to these guys and they work up a band arrangement. And I'm assuming that these guys may not have been involved. They may or may not have been involved with all the recording of the album. But anyway, they're his band guys. They've gotten to know each other. It sounds like maybe they were hired guns to start, but they've become really good friends. They want to be more invested. And so he's kind of weighing, I've invested all this money, but how do I give them some ownership so they stay invested? And what's a fair way to do it?
Well, yeah, I think there's a lot of ways of tackling that. One thing I did for a while before I moved away from Oregon is that, you know, it was Chris Rowley and the Fear of Heights. It was a dedicated band, but I was the leader. I wrote all the songs, kind of similar to what you're talking about. You know, they contributed to the arrangements. But I wanted them to have a sense of ownership in it. So I told them it was kind of a gentleman's agreement, but basically like, we'll split everything, you know, evenly out of these particular revenue streams for as long as this particular lineup continues to work towards that goal. And then, you know, let's say the band breaks up. Those songs, even though I've been sharing publishing revenue or whatever, you know, it's like we never made much money to really, you know, quit our jobs or anything. So this is, you know, we're talking about small amounts of money, but it, you know, if that band stops working together, the publishing rights continue with me. And, but until then I split the publishing money. We divvy up the gig money, all that sort of stuff. So I felt like it was a way I retained ownership technically on paper so that those assets or whatever, the copyrights could continue with me, but I could also give them something for all their time and investment.
Yeah, here's my advice to Connor. Also, he doesn't mention whether it's a, like, it's under his name or there is a band name, but that he just had a revolving door of people and these guys stuck around. So I'm also going to assume that it's under his name. I would say, Connor, either way, it's your deal. I think trying to negotiate with five different people who all have five different ideas and trying to get a consensus is the wrong approach. Because if it's your deal where they're your songs and you're being gracious to cut them in, you just need to decide what it is. So that might upset somebody, but that's the only way it's going to be fair. Because if you're generating most of the output, if success did happen, your feelings would change. if you were siphoning off all your money to people that started having varying degrees of interest compared to you. So I would say, you know, you've already cut them in on some of the recording money. I think that's more than fair. I think that basically what you need to do is decide for live shows, this is what how we're going to treat the money, whether we split it evenly or I get a little bit bigger chunk because it's my name or what. Probably splitting it evenly is the best way to go. But then I would say for the recording money, if you want to give them a percentage, fine, figure out something. Just I would say you say this is what we're going to do. Because if you keep trying to go around and around, people that have various levels of investment in your music are going to just cause problems and have all different ideas.
Yeah, I think that's good advice, particularly because I don't know how old Connor is, but like, you know, when you look at the course of your entire music career going forward, these guys might be super invested and that's awesome. But how, you know, is it for 2 years? Is it 3 years? Is it 20? You don't know. And people's lives can change quick. They could fall in love, have a kid, whatever. And then 5 years down the road, you have a whole completely different band or you're performing solo. And so it is important to keep control of your songs.
Yeah. And I can say that I've seen bands where they've had people that are all equal partners. And a couple of the people are really responsible for writing the song, driving the band, booking shows, doing everything. And a couple other people are just, they, not that they're dead weight, but they may provide some talent. So they may contribute. They may like playing live, but as far as like driving things forward, they're not a part of that. Those people can lose interest real fast. Like you said, they get married, they have a kid. They decide, ah, I'm bored of this. So it's important to understand that you need to have a little protection of your creativity, but being generous to those that are actually helping you accomplish what you need to accomplish. Because if you want to be a band and you need players, they're not going to do it forever just for the fact that they get to play with you.
Yeah. Well, and all of these warnings aside, I do think it's worth saying like how awesome that you have people who are willing to invest time and even money into something that was not initially theirs. They want to buy into what you've already done, which is pretty awesome. So congrats on that.
Yeah. And I think this, it would be interesting to get somebody on the show that has done a lot of band agreements. I know we did that. We talked about band agreements in the episode where I had a copyright lawyer on and he mentioned them briefly. It's important to get those done and nobody does them, but we still should. But it would be interesting to get different scenarios, how people structured their band. It's just hard to find somebody who's going to divulge that information for us all to hear in detail that really, you know, sort of gives a really behind the scenes picture of how a certain band functions. And sometimes people don't want that information known. So it's really hard to get the nitty gritty details, but I'll keep looking. I think that's a good idea. Well, thanks for those emails. You can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com, or you can call our listener line at 360-524-2209. You know, if you email us or call, your question or comment might just end up on a future edition of the podcast. Chris, any closing thoughts?
No, I'll just get to work on those 60 song demos and I'll email them. I'll email them to you as attachments, one at a time.
One at a time.
Right, right.
In WAV files.
No, I'm just kidding. I'll create some Dropbox for you.
Yeah, you can hit Chris up on Twitter and he can start sending you songs. And reminder, DIYMusicianCon.com. If you want to join us in Nashville, which you should, in August, which is just next month, August 25th through 27th, get your tickets. I would encourage you to stop what you're doing and get them now, because they might be sold out if you wait too long. And if you are going to be in town on the 24th, all day that Thursday, don't forget to email me if you're interested in taking part in the YouTube pop-up studio. It will be a really cool thing and cool experience for you. And I will send you a link where you can submit for that opportunity. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast in iTunes and all that kind of stuff.
And follow us on Twitter and Instagram and MySpace and Facebook.
All the places. All right. Well, I gotta get home and start recording some guitar tracks.
Oh, yeah. Good luck with
trouble.
Your pizza and beer.
All right, well, that's going to do it. We'll catch you next time.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.